Palin's face went ashen. "Richard, if Nicholas is dead, how are we going to get the antidote?" "There isn't any antidote. Nicholas wanted me dead. He would have destroyed the antidote long ago. He gave you a fake to be able to capture you." Her face had gone from joy to horror.
"But without the antidote..."
Chapter 64. "There's no time to worry about the poison just now," Richard told her as he helped her to her feet.
"No time?"
She watched his step falter as he made his way across the room. He groped for the window ledge. At the small window opening in the outer wall of the fortification, he signaled with the high, clear whistle of the common wood peewee, the whistle Kara thought was that of the mythical short-tailed pine hawk. "I used a ladder pole," he explained. "Kara is on her way." Kaelin tried to make her way over to him, but her body felt alarmingly unfamiliar to her. She staggered a couple of steps, her legs moving woodenly. She had the urge to get down on her hands and feet to walk. She felt like a stranger inside her own skin. It seemed foreign to have to breathe on her own, to have to look through her own eyes, to have to listen through her own ears. It was a strange, haunting sensation to feel her clothes against her skin. Richard held out his hand to help steady her. Kaelin thought that as wobbly as she was, she might still be more steady on her feet than Richard. "We're going to have to fight our way out," he said. "But we'll have some help. I'll get you the first sword I can." Richard blew out the flame of the single candle before a tin reflector on a small shelf.
"Richard, I'm not yet used to being back inside myself. I don't think I'm ready to go out there. I can hardly walk."
"We don't have a lot of choice. We have to get out. Learn as you go. I'll help you."
"You can hardly walk yourself."
Kara, at the top of a pole ladder Richard had cut, leaned in and wriggled in through the small window. Halfway in, Kara gaped in delighted wonder.
"Mother Confessor! Lord Rawl did it!"
"You don't need to sound so surprised," Richard griped as he helped the moored Sith the rest of the way in. Kara only briefly took note of the dead man sprawled across the floor before Kaelin threw her arms around the woman.
"You can't imagine how glad I am to see you," Kara said. "Well, you can't imagine how glad I am to see you through my own eyes."
"If only the trade you made had worked," Kara added in a whisper.
"We'll find another way," Kaelin assured her.
Richard slowly drew the door open a crack and peeked out. He shut the door and turned back. "It's clear. Doors to the left and around the balcony are the rooms with the women in them. Stairs to the right are the closest that lead down. Some of the rooms at the bottom have officers, others are barracks for soldiers." Kara nodded.
"I'm ready."
Kaelin looked from one to the other.
"Ready for what?"
Richard took her by the elbow. "I need you to help me see."
"Help you see? Is it progressing that fast?"
"Just listen. We're going to move along the balcony to the left and open the doors. Do your best to keep the women calm. We're going to break them out of here." Kaelin was a bit confused by everything. It was completely different from the plan she had been hearing along with Nicholas. She knew she would just have to follow Richard and Kara's lead. Outside, on the simple wooden balcony, there were no lamps or torches. The moon was down behind the black sprawl of the mountains. Kaelin's sight, when Nicholas had controlled her, had been like looking through a greasy pane of wavy glass. The sparkling vault of stars overhead had never looked so beautiful. In that starlight, Kaelin could see simple buildings lined up around the outer wall of the fortification. Richard and Kara moved along the balcony, opening doors. At each one, Kara quickly ducked inside. Some of the women came out in their nightshirts. Some Kaelin could hear inside rushing to get dressed. In some of the rooms, babies cried. While Kara was in one of the rooms, Richard opened another door. He leaned close to Kaelin and whispered, "Go in and tell the women inside that we've come to help them escape. Tell them that their men have come to get them out. But they must be as quiet as possible or we'll be caught." Kaelin rushed in, as best she could on unsteady legs, and shook the young woman in the bed to the right. She sat up, terrified but silent. Kaelin reached around and shook the woman in the other bed.
We've come to help you escape. You mustn't make any noise. Your men are going to help. You have a chance to be free.
Free?
The first woman asked. Yes, it's up to you, but I strongly advise you to take the chance and to hurry. The women flew out of their beds and grabbed for clothes. Richard, Kalin, and Kara moved farther down the balcony, asking the women who had already come out to rouse the others. In a matter of a few minutes, hundreds of women were huddled together out on the balcony. There was no problem keeping them quiet. They were all too familiar with the consequences of causing trouble. They didn't want to do anything to get themselves caught trying to escape. Before long, they had made it all the way around the fortification balcony. Many of the women had very young babies, ones too young to be taken away. The babies were mostly sound asleep in their mother's arms, but some of them started to cry. The mothers desperately tried to rock and cuddle them to silence. Kalin hoped that it was a common enough sound that it wouldn't draw the attention of the soldiers.
"Wait here," Richard whispered to Kalin. "Keep everyone up here until we get the gate open."
With Kara right behind him, Richard slipped carefully down the steps and started across the open yard. When one of the babies suddenly started bawling, soldiers came out of a building to see what was going on. They spotted Richard and Kara. The soldiers started yelling, sounding an alarm. Kalin heard the distinctive ring of steel as Richard drew his sword. Men rushed out of some of the doors, heading Richard and Kara off. Being used to dealing with these people, the men rushing toward Richard apparently weren't greatly concerned about violence. They were wrong, and fell as soon as they got close enough for Richard to strike. Some Richard took down as he ran, others Kara caught as they tried to come in from the side. The screams of some of the men as they fell woke the whole encampment. Men rushed out of barracks below, pulling on their trousers and shirts, dragging weapons belts behind. In the faint starlight, Kalin spotted Richard by the drop gate. He took a mighty swing. Sparks showered across the wall as the sword shattered one of the heavy chains holding up the gate. Richard ran to the other side to cut the other chain. Two men caught up to him there. In one fluid movement, Richard cut them both down. As Kara dropped other men who were rushing in at Richard, he swung the sword again. White-hot fragments of steel filled the air along with the ringing sound of metal shattering. The gate groaned and slowly started to fall outward. Richard heaved his weight against it, and it picked up speed. With a resounding crash, it came down, raising clouds of dust. A great cry rose up as men outside, wielding swords, axes, and battle maces, charged in across the broken bridge and into the fortification. The soldiers rushed to meet the invasion, and there was a great clash of weapons and men. Kalin saw then that soldiers were racing up the stairway on the opposite side of the balcony.
"Come on!"
Kalin yelled to the women.
"We have to get out now!"
Holding the rail to keep her balance, Kalin raced down the steps, all the women pouring down behind her, a number carrying screaming babies. Richard ran to meet her at the bottom. He tossed her a short sword with a leather-wound grip. Kalin caught it by the handle just in time to turn and slash a soldier running up from beneath the balcony. Owen made his way through the fighting and over to the women.
"Come on!"
he called to them.
"Get to the gate! Run!"
The women, galvanized by his command, started running across the compound. As they reached the fighting, some of the women, instead of running out the gate, instead took the opportunity to leap on the backs of soldiers fighting Owen and his men. The women bit the men on the backs, beat at their heads, tore at their eyes. The soldiers were not restrained in dealing with the women, and several were brutally killed. It didn't stop others from joining the fight. If they would only run for the gate, they could escape, but instead, they were attacking the soldiers with their bare hands. They had been held in bondage to these men for a very long time. Kalin could only imagine what they had gone through and couldn't say she blamed them. She was still having difficulty moving, making her body do what she wanted it to do, or she would have joined them. Kalin turned at a sound, only to see a man charging in at her. She recognized his flattened nose. Najari, Nicholas's right-hand man. He was one of the men who had carried her to the fortification. He wore a wicked grin as he came for her. She could have used her power on him, but she feared to trust it right then. She instead brought the short sword out from behind her back and slammed it through Najari's gut. He stood stiffly right in front of her, his eyes wide. She could smell the stink of his breath. Kaelin wrenched the handle of the sword to the side. Mouth open wide, he panted, fearing to draw a deep breath, fearing to move and cause any more damage. Kaelin gritted her teeth and swept the sword's handle around in an arc, ripping his insides apart. She stared into his startled eyes as he slid off her sword. He grunted in pain as he dropped to his knees, holding his wound together as best he could. He never got what Kaelin knew he intended, what Nicholas had promised him. He fell forward onto his face, spilling his insides across the ground at her feet. Kaelin turned to the attack. Richard was engaged in slashing his way through men trying to surround him as he fought to keep the gate clear. Others, Richard's men, came at the enemy from behind, cutting into them the way Richard had taught them. Kaelin saw Owen not far away. He was standing in the open, among the fallen and the fighting, staring across the raging battle to a man just outside one of the doors under the balcony. The man had a thick black beard, a shaved head, and a ring through one ear and one nostril. His arms were as big as tree limbs. His shoulders were twice as wide as Owen's.
"Lu-Chan!" Owen said to himself.
Owen started across the open area of the fortification, past men engaged in pitched battle, past those crying out and those falling to blades, past swords and axes sweeping through the air as if he didn't even see them. His eyes were locked on the man watching him come. The face of a young woman appeared in the dark doorway behind Lu-Chan. He turned and growled at her to go back inside, that he was going to take care of the little man from her village. When Lu-Chan turned back around, Owen was standing before him. Lu-Chan laughed and put his fists on his hips.
"Why don't you scurry back into your hole?"
Owen said nothing, gave no warning, made no demands. He simply lit into Lu-Chan with a vengeance, just as Richard had counseled him to do, slamming a knife into the big man's chest over and over before Lu-Chan had a chance to react. He had underestimated Owen. It had cost him his life. The woman rushed out of the doorway and came to a halt over the body of her former master. She stared down at him, at his one arm lying out to the side, at the other lying across his bloody chest, at the unseeing eyes. She looked up at Owen. Kaelin assumed that this was Marilee, and feared that she was going to reject Owen for harming another, that she would castigate him for what he had done. Instead, she rushed to Owen and threw her arms around him. The woman went to her knees beside the body and took the bloody knife from Owen's hand. She turned to the fallen Lu-Chan and stabbed him half a dozen times with such force that it drove the knife in up to the hilt with every thrust. Watching her tearful fury, Kaelin didn't have to wonder how she had been treated by the man. Her anger spent, she stood again and tearfully hugged Owen. Kaelin needed to get to Richard. She was relieved that her ability to move as she intended was returning. She started making her way around the edge of the battle, staying close to the walls, past men who saw her and thought she would be an easy mark. They didn't know that from a young age she had been taught to use a sword by her father, King Wyborn, and that Richard had later honed her skill to deadly proficiency, teaching her how to use her lighter weight to give her lethal speed. It was the last mistake the men made. Off across the open area, a mob of soldiers, now fully awake and fully prepared to engage in battle, swarmed out of the barracks. They all charged for Richard. Kaelin knew right away that there were too many. Richard's men couldn't stop the flood of soldiers as they streamed across the encampment. All of them crashed in toward Richard. Kaelin heard a deafening crack like lightning as the walls of the fortification lit with a flash. She had to turn away and shield her eyes. Night turned to day, and at the same time, a darkness darker than any night was loosed.
A blazing, white-hot bolt of additive magic twisted and coiled around and through a crackling black void of subtractive magic, creating a violent rope of twin lightning joined to a terrible purpose. It seemed as if the noonday sun crashed down among them. The air itself was drawn into the fierce heat and light. Try as she might, Kaelin couldn't draw a breath against the force of it. Richard's fury gathered it all into a single point. In an explosive instant, the thunderous ignition of light unleashed a devastating blast of staggering destruction, radiating outward toward the entire encampment, annihilating the Imperial Order soldiers. The night fell dark and silent. Men and women stood stunned among the sea of blood and viscera, gazing around at the unrecognizable remains of the enemy soldiers. The battle was over. The people of Bandakar had carried the day. At last the women fell to wailing and crying, ecstatic to be free. They knew many of the men who had come to free them and clung to them in gratitude, overwhelmed with joy to be reunited. They hugged friends, relatives, and strangers alike. The men, too, wept with relief and happiness. Kaelin rushed through the maze of rejoicing people crowded into the open area of the fortification. Men cheered her, thrilled that she, too, had been liberated. Many of the men wanted to talk to her, but she kept running to get to Richard. He stood to the side, leaning against the wall, Kara helping to hold him up. He still gripped his blood-slicked sword in his fist, the blade's tip resting on the ground. Owen, too, made his way over to Richard.
"Mother Confessor, I'm so relieved and thankful to have you back."
He looked to a smiling Richard.
"Lord Rawl, I would like you to meet Marilee."
This woman, who only a short time ago had savagely stabbed the corpse of her captor, now seemed too shy to speak. She dipped her head in greeting. Richard straightened and smiled, that smile Kaelin so loved to see. A smile filled with the sheer pleasure of life. "I'm very happy to meet you, Marilee. Owen has told us all about you and about how much you mean to him. Through all that happened, you were always first in his mind and heart. His love for you moved him to act to change his entire empire for the better." She seemed to be overwhelmed by it all and by his words.
"Lord Rawl came to us and did something more important than saving us all," Owen told Marilee. "Lord Rawl gave me the courage to come and fight for you, to fight to save you, for all of us to fight for our own lives and the lives of those we love."
Beaming, Marilee leaned in and kissed Richard on the cheek.
"Thank you, Lord Rawl. I never knew my Owen could do such things."
"Believe me," Kara said, "we had our doubts about him, too." She clapped Owen on the back of the shoulder. "But he did well."
"I, too, have come to understand the value of what he has done," Marilee said to Richard, "of the things you seem to have taught our people."
Richard smiled at the two of them, but then he could no longer hold back the coughing that so hurt him. The mood of joyous liberation suddenly changed. People rushed in around them, helping to hold him up. Kaelin saw blood running down his chin.
"Richard!" she cried. "No!"
They eased him to the ground. He clutched at Kaelin's sleeve, wanting to have her close. Kaelin saw tears running down Kara's cheek. It seemed that he had spent all the strength he had left. He was slipping into the fatal grasp of the poison, and there was nothing they could do for him.
"Owen,"
Richard said, panting to catch his breath, when the spell of coughing stopped.
"How far to your town?"
His voice was getting hoarse.
"Not far. Only hours if we hurry."
"The man who made the poison and the antidote, he lived there?"
"Yes, his place is still there."
"Take me there."
Owen looked puzzled, but he nodded eagerly.
"Of course."
"Hurry,"
Richard added, trying to get up. He couldn't. Tom appeared in the crowd. Jensen was there, too.
"Get some poles," Tom commanded, "and some canvas or blankets. We'll make a litter. 4 men at a time can carry him. We can run and get him there quickly."
Men rushed to the building, searching for what they would need to make a litter. Chapter 65. Kalin hurriedly pulled the tin off the shelf and opened the lid. The tin contained a yellowish powder. It was the right color. She leaned down and showed it to Richard as he lay in the litter. He reached in and took a pinch. He smelled it. He put his tongue to it and then nodded.
"Just a little,"
he whispered, lifting it out to her. Kalin held out her palm while he dribbled some of the crushed powder in her hand. He threw the rest on the floor, too weak to bother returning it to the tin. Kalin added the small portion on her palm to one of the pots of boiling water. Cloth bags of herbs steeped in other pots of hot water. Alkaloids from dried mushrooms were soaking in oil. Richard had other people grating stalks of plants.
"Lobella,"
Richard said. His eyes were closed. Owen bent down.
"Lobella?"
Richard nodded.
"It will be a dried herb."
Owen turned to the shelves and started looking. There were hundreds of little square cubby holes in the wall of the place where the man who had made Richard's poison and the antidote used to work. It was a small, simple, single-room building with little light. It was not nearly as well equipped as the herbalist places Kalin had seen before. But the man had an extensive collection of things. More than that, he had once made the antidote, presumably from what was there.
"Here," Owen said, holding a bag down for Richard to see. "It says Lobella on the tag."
"Grind a little pile half the size of your thumbnail. Sift out the fibers and discard them. Then add what's left to the bowl with the darker oil."
Richard knew about herbs, but he didn't know anywhere near enough about herbs to concoct the cure for the poison he had been given. His gift seemed to be doing that. Richard was in a near trance, or nearly unconscious. Kalin wasn't exactly sure which. He was having difficulty breathing. She didn't know what else to do to help him. If they didn't do something, he was going to die, and soon. As long as he lay quietly on the litter, he was resting more comfortably. But that was not going to make him recover. It had been a short run to Witherton, but it had taken too long as far as Kalin was concerned.
"Yarrow,"
Richard said. Kalin leaned down.
"What preparation?"
"Oil,"
Richard said. Kalin fumbled through the shelves of small bottles. She found one labeled Yarrow Oil. She squatted down and held it before Richard.
"How much?"
She lifted one of his hands and put the bottle in it, closing his fingers around it so he could tell the size.
"How much?"
"Is it full?"
Kalin hurriedly wiggled out the whittled wooden stopper.
"Yes."
"Half,"
Richard said.
"In with any of the other oils."
"I found the feverfew,"
Jensen said as she hopped down from the stool.
"Make a tincture,"
Richard told her. Kalin replaced the stopper in the bottle and squatted down beside Richard.
"What next?"
"Make an infusion of mullein."
"Mullein, mullein,"
Kalin mumbled as she turned to the task. As Richard gave them instructions, half a dozen people worked at boiling, blending, crushing, grating, filtering, and steeping. They added some of the preparations together as they were completed, and kept others separate as they worked on them. As they worked, the number of various tasks were combined and reduced at specific points. Richard gestured for Owen. Owen brushed his hands clean on his trouser legs as he bent down to await instructions.
"Cold,"
Richard said, his eyes closed.
"We need something cold. We need a way to cool it."
Owen thought for a moment. "There's a stream not far." Richard pointed to various stations where people labored.
"Pour those bowls of preparations and powders into the boiling water in the kettle there. Then take it to the stream. Hold the kettle down in the water to cool it."
Richard held up a finger in caution.
"Don't put it in too deep and let the water from the stream run in over the top, or it will be ruined."
Owen shook his head.
"I won't."
He stood impatiently as Kalin poured the contents of shallow bowls into the boiling pot of water. She didn't know if any of this made sense, but she knew that Richard had the gift, and he certainly had figured out and eliminated the problem he had been having with it. If his gift could guide him in making the antidote, it might save his life. Kalin didn't know anything else that would.
She handed the kettle to Owen. He ran out the door to put it in the stream to cool it. Kara followed him out to make sure that nothing happened to what might be the only thing that could save Richard's life. Jensen sat on the floor on the other side of him, holding his hand. With the back of her wrist, Kaylin pushed her hair off her face. She sat beside Richard and took his free hand to wait for Owen and Kara to return. Betty stood in the doorway, her ears pricked forward, her tail intermittently going into a hopeful blur of wagging whenever Jensen or Kaylin looked her way. It seemed like hours until Owen came running back with the kettle, although Kaylin knew it really hadn't been all that long.
"Filter it through a cloth," Richard said. "But don't squeeze the cloth at the end. Just let the liquid run through until you have a half a cup of it. Once you've done that, then add the oils to the liquid you collected in the cup."
Everyone stood watching Kaylin work, snatching up what she needed, tossing it away when she was finished with it. When she had enough liquid from the kettle collected in the cup, she poured in the oils.
"Stir it with a stick of cinnamon," Richard said.
Owen climbed up on the stool. "I remember seeing cinnamon." He handed a stick down to Kaylin. She stirred the golden liquid, but it didn't seem to be working.
"The oil and water don't want to mix," she told Richard.
His head was rolled to the side away from her.
"Keep mixing. A moment will come when they suddenly come together."
Dubious, Kaylin kept stirring. She could see that the oils were sticking together in globs and not mixing with the water she had filtered through the cloth. The more it cooled, the less and less it looked like it was going to work. Kaylin felt a tear of desperation run down her cheek and drip off her jaw. The contents of the cup stiffened. She kept stirring, not wanting to tell Richard that it wasn't working. She swallowed past the growing lump in her throat. The contents in the cup began to melt. Kaylin gasped. She blinked. Everything in the cup suddenly went together in a smooth, syrupy liquid.
"Richard!" She wiped a tear from her cheek. "It worked! It mixed together! Now what?"
He held out his hand.
"It's ready! Give it to me!"
Jensen and Kara helped him to sit up. Kaylin held the precious cup in both hands and carefully put it to his mouth. She tipped it up to help him drink. It took a while to get it down. He had to stop from time to time as he sipped, trying not to cough. It was a lot more than what was in any of the little square-sided bottles, but Kaylin figured that maybe he needed more since he was so late to be taking it. When he was finished, she reached up and set the cup on the counter. She licked a drop of the liquid off her finger. The antidote had the slight aroma of cinnamon and a sweet, spicy taste. She hoped that was right. Richard worked at recovering his breath after the effort of drinking. They gently laid him back down. His hands were trembling. He looked miserable.
"Just let me rest now," he murmured.
Betty, still standing in the doorway, watching intently, bleated her wish to come in.
"He will be all right," Jensen said to her friend. "You just stay out there and let him rest."
Betty pulled softly, and then lay down in the doorway to wait along with the rest of them. It was going to be a long night. Kaylin didn't think she was going to be able to sleep until she knew if Richard would be all right. Zed pointed.
"There's another one there that needs to be cleaned up," he said to Chase.
Chase wore a chainmail shirt over a tan leather tunic. His heavy black trousers held a black belt, set with a large silver buckle emblazoned with the emblem of the Boundary Wardens. Beneath his black cloak, strapped everywhere, legs, waist, upper arms, over the backs of his shoulders, was a small arsenal of weapons, everything from small thin spikes held in the fist and used to puncture the skull, to a crescent-shaped battle axe used to divide a skull cleanly with one blow. Chase was deadly with any of them. It had been a while now since they needed the skills of a boundary warden. Chase seemed to be a man without a mission. The big man walked across the rampart and bent to pull a knife from beneath the body. He grunted in recognition.
"There it is."
He held the walnut-handled knife up to the light as he inspected it.
"I was worried I'd lost it."
He slipped the knife into an empty sheath without having to look. With one hand he grabbed the waistband of the trousers and picked up the stiff body. He stepped into an opening in the crenellated wall and heaved the body out into the air. Zed looked over the edge. It was a drop of several thousand feet before the rock of the mountain flared enough for anything falling to make contact. It was several thousand more feet down a granite cliff before the forest began. The golden sun was getting low in the mountains. The clouds had taken on streaks of gold and orange. From this distance, the city below was as beautiful as ever, except Zed knew that it was an empty place without the people to bring it life.
"Chase, Zed," Rachel called from the doorway. "The stew is ready."
Zed threw his skinny arms into the air.
"Bags, it's about time. A man could starve waiting for stew to cook."
Rachel planted her fist with the wooden spoon on her hip and shook a finger of her other hand at him.
"If you keep saying bad words, you'll not get any dinner."
Chase let out a sigh as he glanced over at Zed.
"And do you think you have troubles? You wouldn't think that a girl who doesn't come up to my belt buckle could be such a trial."
Zed followed Chase to the doorway through the thick stone wall.
"Is she always this much trouble?"
Chase mussed Rachel's hair on the way past.
"Always," he confided. "Is the stew good?" Zed asked. "Worth watching my language for?"
"My new mother taught me how to make it,"
Rachel said in a tempting sing-song. Zed smoothed back his unruly white hair.
"Well, Emma can cook better than any woman I ever met."
"Then be good," Rachel said, "and I'll give you biscuits to go with the stew."
"Biscuits?"
"Sure. Stew wouldn't be stew without biscuits."
Zed blinked at the child.
"Why, that's what I always thought, too."
"You'd better let me see if she made it right first," Chase said as they passed through the tapestry-lined halls of the keep. "I'd hate you to go making any firm commitments before we even know if the stew is edible."
"Friedrich helped me with the heavy parts," Rachel said. "He says it's good."
"We'll see," Chase said. Rachel turned and shook her wooden spoon up at him.
"You have to wash your hands first, though. I saw you throwing that dead man over the wall. You have to wash your hands before you come to the table and eat."
Chase gave Zed a look of strained forbearance.
"Somewhere, there's a boy enjoying himself right now, probably carrying around a dead frog, oblivious to the sorry fact that he's someday going to be married to Little Miss Wash Your Hands Before You Eat."
Zed smiled. When Chase had taken Rachel in to be his daughter, it was just about the most wonderful thing Zed could ever have wished for. Rachel thought so too, and it looked like she still did. She was fiercely devoted to the man. As they sat at the table, before the cheery fire in the hearth, Zed enjoying his third bowl of stew, he couldn't recall the keep being such a wonderful place. It was because there was a child along with friends once again in the halls of the keep. Friedrich, the man who had come on Rachel's orders to warn Zed of the impending attack on the keep, had realized he had not been in time. The man used his head and had sought out Chase, the old friend he had heard Richard talk about. While Chase had gone to rescue Zed and Addy, Friedrich had returned to the keep to spy on the people who had taken it. By watching carefully and staying out of sight of his sister, Friedrich had been able to provide Chase and Zed invaluable information about the number of people occupying the keep and their routines. Then he helped take the place back. Zed liked the man. He was not only frightfully handy with a knife, but entertaining at conversation. Friedrich, since he had been married to a sorceress, was able to converse with Zed without being intimidated, as some were of wizards. Having lived in Dahara all his life, Friedrich was also able to fill in pieces of information. Rachel held up a carving of a hawk.
"Look what Friedrich made for me, Zed. Isn't it the most beautiful thing you ever did see?"
Zed smiled.
"It certainly is."
"It's nothing," Friedrich scoffed.
"If I had some gold leaf, then I could gild it for you. That used to be what I did for a living."
He leaned back and smiled to himself.
"Until Lord Rawl made me a bounty warden. You know,"
Zed drawled offhandedly to both men.
The keep is even more vulnerable now to those who might come and don't have magic than to those who do. I'm just fine protecting against those who are affected by magic, but not the other kind.
Chase nodded. Seems so.
Well, the thing is, he went on, I was thinking that since there's no boundary any longer, and what with all the trouble about, perhaps you two would like to take on the responsibility of helping to protect the wizard's keep. I'm not nearly so fit for the task as would be someone trained in such things.
Zed leaned in, his brow lowering.
It's vitally important.
Elbows on the table, Chase chewed a bite of biscuit as he watched Zed. Finally, he stirred his spoon around in his bowl.
Well, it could be a disaster if Jigang were to use those ungifted men to get his hands on the place again.
He thought about it. Emma will understand.
Zed shrugged.
Bring her here.
Chase frowned. Bring her here? Zed gestured around.
The keep is certainly big enough.
But what would we do with our children? Chase leaned back. You don't want all my children here in the keep, Zed. They'd be running up and down, playing in the halls. It would drive you batty. Besides, Chase added, peering with one scowling eye at Rachel,
each one's uglier than the next.
Rachel hid her giggle behind a biscuit. Zed remembered the sounds of children's laughter in the keep, the sounds of joy and love.
Well, it would be a burden, he agreed. But this is, after all, about the protection of the keep. What sacrifice wouldn't be worth making to protect the keep?
Rachel looked from Chase to Zed.
My new sister Lee could bring Cat back to you, Zed.
That's right, Zed said, throwing his hands up. I haven't seen Cat for ages. Is Lee treating Cat well?
Rachel nodded earnestly. Oh, yes, we all take good care of Cat.
What do you think, Rachel? Chase finally asked. Would you want to live here in this dusty old place with Zed?
Rachel ran over and hugged Chase's leg.
Oh, yes, can we please? It would be ever so grand.
Chase sighed. Then I guess it's settled, but you'll have to behave and not bother Zed by being too loud.
I promise, Rachel said. She frowned up at Zed. Will Mother have to crawl into the keep through that little tunnel like we did?
Zed chuckled. No, we'll let her come in the proper way, like the lady she is.
He turned to Friedrich.
How about it, Boundary Warden?
Would you be willing to continue doing Lord Rawl's bidding and stay to help guard the keep?
Friedrich slowly spun the bird carving by the tip of one wing, thinking.
You know, Zed added, while you're waiting for some fearsome attack, there are any number of old gilded things here at the keep that are in terrible need of repair. Perhaps you would consider taking on the job of being the keep's official gilder. We have plenty of gold leaf, and someday, when the people return to Aidendrill, you would have a steady supply of customers.
Friedrich stared down at the table.
I don't know. This one adventure was all well and good, but since my wife Althea died, I don't seem to be interested in much.
Zed nodded.
I know how it is. I used to have a wife. I think it would do you good to get paid to do something needed.
Friedrich smiled.
All right, then. I will take your job, wizard.
Good, Chase said. I have someone to help me when I need to lock troublesome children in the dungeon.
Rachel giggled as he set her on the ground. Chase pushed his chair back and stood.
Well, Friedrich, if we're going to be keep wardens, then I think we ought to make some rounds and satisfy ourselves about the security of a few things.
Just mind the shields,
Zed reminded them as they headed for the door. After the two men had gone off, Rachel got Zed another biscuit to go with the rest of his stew. Her little brow bunched together earnestly.
When we live here, we'll try to be real quiet for you, Zed.
Well, you know, Rachel, the keep is a big place. I doubt you would bother me much if you and your brothers and sisters wanted to play a little bit.
Really?
Zed pulled the leather-covered ball, painted with faded blue and pink zigzagged lines all around it, out of his pocket and set it on the table.
Rachel's eyes lit up in astonishment.
"I found this old ball," he said, gesturing with his biscuit. "I think a ball has a much better time if it has someone to play with it. Do you think you and your brothers and sisters might like to play with this when you live here? You can bounce it down the halls to your heart's content."
Her mouth fell open.
"Really, Zed?"
Zed grinned at the look on her face.
"Really?
Maybe I can bounce it in the dark hall that makes the funny noises. Then it wouldn't bother you any more than now."
"This old place is full of funny noises, and a bouncing ball isn't liable to cause too much trouble."
She climbed up in his lap and put her little arms around his neck, hugging him tightly.
"It's a lot better hugging you now that you found those things to get that awful collar off your neck."
Zed rubbed her back as she hugged him.
"Yes, it is, little one. Yes, it is."
She leaned back and looked at him.
"I wish Richard and Kalen could be here to play with the ball, too. I miss them something fierce."
Zed smiled.
"Me too, little one. Me too."
She frowned at him.
"Don't get tears, Zed. I won't make a lot of noise to bother you."
Zed shook a bony finger at her.
"I'm afraid you have a lot to learn about playing with a ball."
"I do?"
"Of course. Laughing goes with playing with a ball like biscuits go with stew."
She frowned at him, not sure if he was telling the truth. He set her on the floor.
"Tell you what. Why don't you come with me and I'll show you."
"Really, Zed?"
Zed stood up and mussed her hair.
"Really?"
He scooped the ball off the table.
"Let's go see if you can show this ball how to have a good time."
Chapter 66. Richard rested his back against a rock in the shade of a stand of white oaks as he gazed off at the line of silver maples shimmering in the breeze. The air smelled fresh after the rain of the day before. The clouds had moved on and left a clear, bright blue sky behind. His head finally felt clear as well. It had taken 3 days, but he was finally recovered from the effects of the poison. His gift had not only helped bring Kalen back from the brink, but himself as well. The people of the town of Witherton were just beginning to try to put their lives back together. With all the people they'd lost, it was going to be difficult for them. There were gaping holes where there used to be friends or members of families. Still, now that they were free, there was the beginning of a vibrant sense of their future being better. But just because they were free, that did not mean they would stay that way. Richard gazed up the broad valley beyond the town. People were out working with their crops and tending to the animals. They were going back to their lives. He was impatient to be on his way and back to his own life. This place had kept them from important business, from people who had been waiting for them. He guessed that this place had been important business as well. It was hard telling what this all had begun or what the future would hold. For sure, the world would never be the same. Richard saw Kalen coming out through the gate, Kara beside her. Betty frolicked along at their side, eager to see where they were going. Jensen must have let the goat go for a romp. Betty had grown up and spent her entire life on the move. She'd never stayed in one place for long. Maybe that was why she always wanted to follow Richard and Kalen. She recognized family and wanted to be with them. "So, what's she going to do?" Richard asked Kalen, as she came close and set her pack down beside Richard's.
"I don't know."
With the flat of her hand to her brow, Kalen shielded her eyes from the sunlight.
"I think she wants to tell you first."
Kara set her pack beside Kalen's. "I think she's torn and doesn't know what to do."
"How do you feel?"
Kalen asked as she reached down and with her fingertips rubbed the back of his shoulder. Her gentle touch was a calming connection. Richard smiled up at her.
"I keep telling you I'm fine."
He tore off a strip of dried venison and chewed as he watched Jensen, Tom, Owen, Merrily, Anson, and a small group of the men finally emerge through the gates and make their way across the waving field of waist-high green grass.
"I'm hungry," Kalen said. "Can I have some?"
"Sure."
Richard pulled strips of the meat from his pack, stood, and handed the piece to both Kalen and Kara.
"Lord Rawl,"
Anson said, waving as the group joined Richard, Kalen, and Kara in the shade of the oaks. We wanted to come out to say goodbye and see you off. Maybe we will walk with you toward the pass? Richard swallowed. We'd like that. Owen frowned. Lord Rawl, why are you eating meat? You just healed your gift. Won't you harm your balance? Richard smiled. No. You see, incorrectly trying to apply a false notion of balance was what caused the problem I was having with my gift. Owen looked puzzled. What do you mean? You said that you must not eat meat, as the balance to the killing you sometimes must do. After the battle at the fortification, don't you need to balance your gift all the more? Richard took a deep breath and let it out slowly as he gazed out over the mountains. You see, the thing is, Richard said, I owe you all an apology. You all listened to me, but I didn't listen to myself. Kaja Rang tried to help me with the words revealed on the statue, the words I told you, deserve victory. They were, first of all, meant for me. I don't understand, Anson said. I told you that your life is your own to live, and that you have every right to defend it. Yet I was telling myself that I had to balance the killing I did to defend my life and the lives of my loved ones by not eating meat. In essence, saying my self-defense, my killing of those who attacked me and other innocent people, was morally wrong. And so for the killing I'd done, I needed to make amends to the magic that helped me by offering it the appeasement of balance. But your sword's magic didn't work either, Jensen said. No, it didn't. And that should have been the thing that made me realize what the problem was, because both my gift and the sword's magic are different entities. Yet they reacted logically to the same unreasoned action on my part. The sword's magic began to fail because I myself, by not eating meat, was saying that I did not completely believe that I was justified in using force to stop others who initiate violence. The sword's magic functions through the belief structure of the sword's owner. It only works against what the seeker himself perceives as the enemy. The sword's magic will not work against a friend. That was the key I should have understood. When I thought that the use of the sword had to be balanced, I was in effect expressing a belief that my actions were in some way unjustified. Therefore, because I held that remnant of faith in a false concept that had been inculcated in me throughout my life, just as all the people of Bandakar were taught, that killing was always wrong, the sword's magic began to fail me. The Sword of Truth's magic, as my gift, could only again be viable when I comprehended completely that the magic needs no balance for the killing I've done, because the killing I've done is not only moral, but the only moral course of action I could have taken. By not eating meat, I was acknowledging that some part of my mind believed the same thing that the people here in Bandakar believed when we first met Owen and his men, that killing is always wrong. By thinking that I must not eat meat as a balance, I was denying the moral necessity of self-preservation, denying the essential of protecting the value of life. The very act of seeking balance for what I'm right in doing is a conflict, which is what was causing the headaches, and also caused the Sword of Truth's power to fail me. I was doing it to myself. Richard had violated the wizard's first rule by believing a lie, that it was always wrong to kill, because he feared it was true. He had also violated the second rule, among others, but most grievous of all, he had violated the sixth rule. In so doing, he had ignored reason in favor of blind faith. The failure of his gift and the sword's power was a direct result of not applying reasoned thought. Fortunately, with the eighth rule, he had come to re-examine his actions and finally realized the flaw in his thinking. Only then was he able to correct the situation. In the end, he had fulfilled the eighth rule. Richard shifted his weight to the other foot as he gazed at the faces watching him. I had to come to understand that my actions are moral and need no balance, but are in themselves balanced by my reasoned actions, that killing is sometimes not only justified, but the only right and moral thing to do. I had to come to understand the very thing I was asking all of you to understand. I had to understand that I must deserve victory. Owen looked over at those with him and then scratched his head.
Well, considering everything, I guess we can understand how you could make such a misjudgment.
Jensen, her red hair standing out against the green of the trees and fields, squinted at him in the sunlight.
Well, she said with a sigh, I'm glad to be pristinely ungifted. Being a wizard sounds awfully hard.
The men all nodded while voicing their agreement. Richard smiled at Jensen. A lot of things in life are hard to figure out, like what you've been considering. What have you decided? Jensen clasped her hands and glanced over at Owen, Anson, and all the rest of the people with them.
Well, this is no longer a banished empire. It's no longer an empire naked to the aggression of tyrants. It's part of the Dharan Empire. Now, these people want the same as us. I think I'd like to stay with them for a while and help them come to be part of the wider world, just as I've been starting to do. It's kind of exciting. I'd like to take your suggestion, Richard, and help them in that.
Richard smiled at his sister. He ran his hand down her beautiful red hair.
On a condition, she added.
Richard let his hand drop back.
Condition? Sure. I'm a Rawl, so I was kind of thinking that I ought to have some proper protection. I could be a target, you know. People want to kill me. Jigang would love to.
Richard laughed as he drew her into a hug with one arm to silence her.
Tom, being as you are a protector to the House of Rawl, I'm assigning you to protect my sister Jensen Rawl. It's an important job and it means a great deal to me.
Tom lifted an eyebrow.
Are you sure, Lord Rawl?
Jensen swatted him with the back of her hand.
Of course he's sure. He wouldn't say it unless he was sure.
You heard the lady, Richard said. I'm sure.
The big blonde Dharan smiled with a boyish grin.
All right, then. I swear I will protect her, Lord Rawl.
Jensen gestured vaguely back at the men and the town behind her.
Since I've been with them, they have come to see that I'm not a witch, and Betty is not a spirit guide, although for a time there I was afraid they might be right about Betty.
Richard peered down at the goat. Betty cocked her head. I guess none of us but Betty knew the truth of what Nicholas was up to. At the sound of her name, Betty's ears pricked forward, and her tail went into a fit of expectant wagging. Jensen patted Betty's round middle.
Now that these people understand that I'm not a witch, but I do share some of their traits, I suggested I might play an important role.
She drew the knife at her belt and held it up, showing Richard the ornate letter R engraved on the silver handle.
I suggested that I be the official representative of the House of Rawl, if you approve.
Richard grinned. I think that's an excellent idea.
I think that would be wonderful, Jensen, Kaelin pointed to the east with her chin. But don't wait too long before you get back to Houghton to see Anne and Nathan. They will be a valuable help in ensuring that the people here are no longer the prey of the Imperial Order. They will help you.
Jensen twisted her fingers together.
But aren't they going to want to be going with the both of you, helping you?
Anne thinks she should direct Richard's life, Kaelin said. I don't think some of her directions have been the best thing. She slipped her arm through Richard's.
He is the Lord Rawl now. He needs to do things his way, not theirs.
They both feel responsible for us, Richard explained. Nathan Rawl is a prophet. Prophecy, because of the way it functions, actually does require balance. The balance to prophecy is free will. I am the balance. I know those two don't like it, but I think I need to be free of them, for now at least. But there is more to it. I think it's more important that they help the people here first. We already know the uses to which Jigang will put the pristinely ungifted. I think it's vital that these people here, who are willing to value and protect the freedom they've won, are given some guidance in how to do that. Anne and Nathan will be able to set up defenses that will help protect the people here. They will also be valuable in teaching you the history that is important for you to know. After Richard picked up his pack and slipped his arms through the straps, Owen gripped Richard's hand.
Thank you, Lord Rawl, for showing me that my life is worth living.
Merrily stepped forward and hugged him.
Thank you for teaching Owen to be worthy of me.
Richard laughed. Owen laughed. Kara gave Merrily an approving clap on the back. And then all the men laughed.
Betty pushed in and with a flurry of tail wagging got the point across that she didn't want to be left out. Richard knelt down and scratched Betty's ears. "And you, my friend, from now on, I don't want you letting any slies using you to spy on people." Betty pushed her head against his chest as he scratched her ears and bleated as if to say she was sorry. Chapter 67. Alone at last beneath the vast blue sky, the soaring walls of snow-capped mountains, and in among the trees, Richard felt good about being on their way. He would miss Jensen, but it was only for a time. It would do her good to be on her own, yet among people also discovering how to live their own lives as they learned more about the wider world. He knew he would not trade away all he had learned since he'd left his sheltered life in Heartland. If not for that, he wouldn't be with Kalen. It felt good to walk and stretch his legs. He hitched his bow up higher on his shoulder as they made their way through the dappled sunlight of the hushed forest floor. After being so close to death, as well as to losing his ability to see, he found everything more vibrant. The mosses looked more lush, the leaves more shimmery, the towering pines more awe-inspiring. Kaylin's eyes seemed more green, her hair softer, her smile warmer. As much as he at one time had hated the fact that he had been born gifted, he was now relieved to have his gift back. It was part of him, part of who he was, part of what made him the individual he was. Kaylin had once asked him if he wished she had been born without her confessor's power. He had told her that he would never wish that, because he loved her for who she was. There was no way to separate out the parts of a person. That was to deny their individuality. He was no different. His gift was part of who he was. His abilities touched everything he did. His problem with his gift was of his own making. The magic of the Sword of Truth had helped him understand that by failing him. In so doing, it revealed his own failure to recognize the truth. To have it back at his hip, and to know that it was once again in harmony with him and ready to defend him and those he loved, was a comforting feeling, not because he wished to fight, but because he wished to live. The day was warm, and they made good time climbing the rocky trail up into the pass. By the time they reached the crown of the notch through the formidable mountains, it was colder, but without a biting wind it was not unpleasant. At the top of the pass they stopped to gaze up at the statue of Kajarang, sitting where it had been for thousands of years, all alone, standing vigil over an empire of those who once could not see evil. In some ways, the statue's presence was a monument to failure. Where Kajarang and his people had failed to get these people to see the truth, Richard had succeeded, but not without Kajarang's help. Richard put his hands to the cold granite, to the words, "Talga Vasternish," that had helped save his life. "Thank you," he whispered up at the face of the man staring off toward the Pillars of Creation, where Richard had discovered his sister. Kara placed her hands over the words, and Richard was surprised to see her look up at the statue and say, "Thank you for helping to save Lord Rawl." After they started descending the pass, first crossing the open ledges and then making it down into the dense woods, Richard heard the call of a peewee, the signal he had taught Kara that had served them so well. "You know," Kara said as she led them down the rocky ground beside a small stream, "Anson knows a lot about birds." Richard stepped carefully among the tangle of cedar roots.
"Really?"
"Yes. While you were recovering, we spent time talking." She put a hand against the fibrous bark of the reddish trunk of a cedar to keep her balance. She pulled her long, blonde braid forward over her shoulder as she started out again, running her hand down the length of the braid. "He complimented me on my bird whistle," Kara said. Richard glanced at Kaylin. She shrugged to let him know that she didn't know what Kara was getting at. "I told you that you had learned it well," Richard said.
"I told him that you had taught it to me, that it was the call of the short-tailed pinehawk.
Anson said that there wasn't any such bird as a short-tailed pinehawk.
He said the call I used as a signal, the call you taught me,
was a common wood peewee. Me, a moored Sith, using the call of a bird called a peewee. Imagine that.
They walked in silence for a moment.
Am I in trouble?
Richard finally asked.
Oh, yes, Kara answered.
Richard couldn't help smiling, but he made sure the moored Sith didn't see it. Nor did Kara see Kalen look back over her shoulder with the special smile she gave no one but him. Kalen lifted an arm, pointing.
Look!
Through the gaps in the crowns of the cedars, against the bright blue sky, they saw a black-tipped race circling high above them, riding the mountain air currents. The races were no longer hunting them. This one was simply looking for its dinner.
What's that old saying? Kara asked. Something about a bird of prey circling over you at the beginning of a journey being a warning sign?
Yes, that's right, Richard said. But I'm not going to let that old tale bother me. We'll let you come with us anyway.
Kalen laughed and received a scolding scowl. Kalen laughed all the more when Richard started laughing too.
Kara couldn't hold out, and as she turned back to the trail, Richard saw the smile spread across her face.
Naked Empire by Terry Goodkind. Read by Jim Bond.